What would you do if you woke up to an official government alert that missiles were inbound? Hello and welcome to Tech First. My name is John Kutsir. On January 13th, 2018, at 8:08 a.m., an alert was issued to 1.4 million citizens of Hawaii. Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. Wow, imagine getting that message first thing in the morning. Some people called 911, some must have panicked. What was it like to think your world might be ending? We're joined today by Michaela Ternaski-Holland. She's an Emmy Award-winning XR director who makes experiences in VR as well as linear narrative, created The Morning You Wake about that event. Welcome, Michaela.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here and excited to discuss the project.
Awesome. Super pumped to have you as well. I mean, I want to talk about the project, but I also want to talk about the technology and what you built. And I want to talk about the experience of understanding a story through this kind of technology. I want to talk about the future of what this looks like for storytelling and video and narration and documentaries and all this stuff. But let's start with the project. What was the project and how did you get involved?
So, On the Morning You Wake to the End of the World is a three-part VR documentary about the threat of nuclear weapons. The idea for the project actually came from Princeton University's Science and Global Security program. They were interested in creating The Next Day After Tomorrow, which was a really impactful documentary that some people say might have changed the mind of President Reagan, who started to slowly but surely end the Cold War against Russia after seeing the effects that nuclear weapons could and do have on the world. So the project really started out as this idea of being a world-changing, socially impactful project. Princeton University approached Games for Change as a partner in this because they were really interested in exploring the use cases of emerging technology, especially virtual reality, because of the way that virtual reality gives you that sense of intimacy, because of the way that virtual reality really can take you on a journey. They were really looking for something that could activate the audience versus making the audience passive. And so they went on a multi-year journey with Games for Change to not only figure out how they could tell a more human story around nuclear weapons threat versus one that was more research-based and fact-oriented and materials-oriented, and one that really felt like it took you into a moment that was very human. But they also went on a multi-year journey with Games for Change to identify the best partners to be involved in the project, to identify the best production companies, the best creative technologists. And then, of course, when I came into the project towards the end of the production, they were really looking to figure out who could be the best person to execute this international multi-prong impact campaign around the VR experience. And so the project itself is a 45-minute long experience that really uses point cloud technology and volumetric capture technology, which we can talk about more. But my role on the project was really about everything happening outside of the VR experience. So the creators Archer's Mark and Atlas V and Nova Lab, the creative technology studio, really pushed the boundaries of the technology. But as we know with virtual reality, accessibility is a huge issue. And for Princeton University and Games for Change, they had a vision to bring this project to the United Nations, to students, to general members of the public. And so in order to execute such a huge broad range of impact, you have to have people coming in just to manage the impact campaign. And so my role as a creative strategist and impact producer was really thinking about how would the impact materials interweave with the VR experience? How would the impact experience itself outside of the headset create actual action from the audience members? How would we show up in different spaces, whether that was at the United Nations or the Nobel Peace Center, or if we did like a pop-up in a small art gallery? And I also managed sort of the online presence of the project. So it's social media, it's website, it's design. And in that way, it was really interesting because we like to think of the VR experience as the heart and soul of the project. But the things that I was building around the project are more like the skeleton and the muscles and the legs to actually mobilize the project to people all over the world.
It's really interesting that you framed it the way that you did in terms of Reagan and the morning after, because so many people, when they want to impact change in the world, I don't know, they start a political party or a group or an interest group, or they start yammering about it on social media or doing a lot of other things. And many of those things maybe need to be done, or they print signs and march, and that's all valid and interesting. But there's something about a creative experience that you personally can inhabit that mm-hmm. can really change hearts and minds more than maybe somebody shouting at them or other things like that. That's super interesting. You mentioned taking the VR experience, the XR experience, broader and making sure that it had impact. And that's, of course, a big challenge, right? Because how many headsets are there? How many people have headsets and don't use them? I have a headset back there that I'm not sure I've worn in the last month. So that's a big challenge. How did you try and wrestle with that?
I think the biggest obstacle in VR is, of course, the headsets, but also making sure people feel comfortable with the headsets. So I think it was a two-prong approach. First and foremost, there was sort of a fulfillment side where we were able to gather a fleet of over 30 headsets and trying to figure out how to make those headsets transportable, how to make those headsets easy to manage. We basically had a fleet of hardware. And so it was up to me and my production coordinator and then production manager, Aaron Budd, to figure out what management software we would use for those headsets, how we would cut out the production cases so that we could roll 4 headsets, 2 iPads, power strips. So we figured out the physical logistics of it. But then I think there's also the person logistics of it, where how you set up a VR space to feel welcoming, how you make sure you dictate the flow of people throughout the space, how you make sure people's time and energy is being valued by creating a booking system so people aren't waiting around for an hour and a half to try the VR experience. These were all little things we did. And then I think the most important thing we did is that we really emphasized the training of our docents or our volunteers or whoever was helping us work the exhibit to really make sure they knew how to properly communicate with people. I agree with you, John. There is a lot of falling off people do when they get their headset at home and they don't necessarily wear it every day. But I do think if somebody is out and about in the world and they're interested in trying VR and they're interested in trying out an experience, you've already got them 50% hooked. Where you lose the second 50% of them is when someone forces the headset on their face. It's not very comfortable. It's blurry. They don't know what they're doing. They feel really overwhelmed. And we were, especially because it's a project about nuclear weapons threat, we weren't only trying our best to make sure people felt really comfortable and safe and approachable using the technology, but we wanted to make sure people felt comfortable and safe and approachable talking about such an intense topic like nuclear weapons. And so it sort of fed into the theme of the experience to have our docents take a little more time with people, have our docents be a little more amicable, have our docents spend an extra few minutes making sure they felt super comfortable in the headset, everything was clear, that they knew how to go about the headset. But it also set us up to be able to have these people feel comfortable to explore such an intense topic from such an intense moment in time. Like you said, this false ballistic missile in Hawaii is a very human moment. And one of my favorite parts of the project is in chapter 2, where we actually interview a survivor of Hiroshima who also experienced the false ballistic missile alert. And that's a really big wake-up call for us, because you don't realize like all of these recent events for nuclear weapons, such as Russia invading Ukraine, such as the Hawaii false ballistic missile alert, really does just come right off the heels of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I had to remember and think about when you were talking about people feeling comfortable putting on a headset. When I bought my first VR headset, I bought the PlayStation VR, the first version, and I brought that over to my parents' house. That's got to be a decade ago. I don't even know. Maybe it wasn't even released a decade ago. I'm really bad with the past. But soon after I got it, I brought it over to my parents' house. I asked my mom, do you want to try it? And so she did. And you could hook that set up so you could see what people were seeing on the TV. And so the people around could see what she was seeing. And she was, I want to say, 75 at the time. And PlayStation VR had this experience, the shark experience. I don't know if you ever saw that. I don't know if you ever experienced that. But my mom reacted as if it was real and if she was there. And she was shrieking. We had to pull the headset off her face when the sharks were coming up to the cage. And I'm laughing now. And full transparency, I was laughing then too. So I'm an awful son, I guess. But there is a reality and an immediacy to VR that is super compelling.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why my focus in social impact and documentary has been one that I feel really strongly about when it comes to these kind of technologies. Because, look, I'm not saying you can't have a really impactful moment with a really beautiful framed photo. I'm not saying you can't have a really impactful moment with a really well-edited documentary, traditional film. It's not that those mediums aren't doing their job. It's that the human nature is to continue to strive and make progress and move forward. And so we have perfected the form of passive media entertainment. We have perfected the form of sitting and watching and enjoying. And so for me, what's exciting about this kind of newer emerging technology of virtual reality and augmented reality and digital reality is sort of what I call this big umbrella, even if we're talking about artificial intelligence, because I've worked with that medium as well, it's that it is now we get to explore the realm of active storytelling. We get to explore the realm of the audience being inside of the story, the audience being a part of the story, the audience communicating in conversations with the story. And that is very similar to how we go about our real life. Like, we don't learn things in our real life by being passive and allowing things to just be absorbed. We learned how to walk because we started walking. We learned how to drive a car because we started driving cars, right? And so our world is already a 3D spatialized kind of metaverse environment. We've been in here since we've been born. So now we get to kind of perfect this layer of active storytelling inside of the digital reality. And that's really exciting to me because it can make a really huge impact on people in a way that maybe passive technology, passive media might not, or maybe in the exact same way. A lot of the work I did at Games for Change was also looking at research. So we were surveying people coming in and we found that 75% of the people who saw On the Morning You Wake through one of our impact activations were more likely to check out the information about the topic, or they were willing to explore more information, or they wanted to learn more information. We also found that age was not a factor whatsoever. We had people 80 years old to people who were 14 years old, and they both enjoyed the VR experience around the same amount. They both learned about the same amount of information. They both felt compelled emotionally in a very similar way. And that was really important for us to see that, right? And then another really interesting model we did was a comparative study model where we were researching, if we do a 2D version of this exact experience, just export the VR as a 2D film, and then we also do a VR version, what changes? And the reality is the learning didn't change, but the engagement and the impact changed. And how did we measure that? We measured that through people's emotions. People felt more positive emotions watching the experience in VR than they did watching it on iPad. And people felt those positive emotions more strongly than they did when they were watching on an iPad. So basically, more people watching on an iPad on a passive surface felt more hopeless. They felt more like they couldn't do anything. They felt more frustrated and angry with the system that they were a part of, versus people in VR actually felt more hopeful. They felt more like they could make a difference. They felt like they could take action. They felt like they could make an impact in the world. And they felt those things even more strongly than the people who watched it on iPad who are feeling hopeless or passive. So there is an interesting kind of texture and dynamic that we uncovered using 4,000+ people surveys and some of the research mechanisms that we activated through our impact campaign as well.
I find that fascinating. And I'm glad that you studied the impact versus of 2D versus 6 degrees of freedom and inhabiting the space. The original metaverse is the universe, right? And we're used to experiencing moving, seeing from different angles, different perspectives, and experiencing multiple senses and having things change as we progress through a space. So that's got to be more impactful. And it's cool to hear that it actually was, and research bore that out. I guess the big question is, if you look back at the Reagan situation that you mentioned right off top, the morning after or the day after, and millions, maybe hundreds of millions saw that, who knows? That future for XR, for VR, is still in the future. isn't it? When you can take it not to 4,000 people, not to 20 people at a time, but you can take it to millions, maybe even billions at a time. And I guess maybe that's at one level that feels a little depressing, because you can't bring this kind of experience to a really mass audience. I guess another level it's hopeful, because that future is coming with new headsets and hopefully cheaper prices at some point, and some very expensive ones coming from Apple as well.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. I think I have this conversation a lot with people where, like I was saying before, we've perfected the art of passive storytelling, but we've also perfected the distribution of it. We've also perfected the accessibility to it. And so where we are right now with this newer industry is we're figuring it out. We're figuring out the storytelling. We're figuring out the distribution. We're figuring out the accessibility. No one has the right answer. No one has the wrong answer. We're just throwing things at the wall to see what sticks. And so what I say to a lot of people who are interested in maybe getting involved in VR or telling a story in VR, because I work as a consultant a lot, is that I tell them, are you interested in quality? Or are you interested in quantity? Because and both are really valuable factors. Like, both are very valuable key performance indicators, as you would say, or KPIs, right? Very valuable. So if I have a brand coming to me and saying, Michaela, we want quantity, then I'll be the first person to tell them, then VR is not the medium for you, right? I'll be the first person to tell them, like, well, maybe you need to rethink your strategy as doing something in the XR world. If they're interested in quality, if they're interested in saying, Michaela, I would rather reach 5 people at 80% than reach 100 people at 6%, right? Because most of these people who came through VR with On the Morning You Wake, most of the people who came through On the Morning You Wake to the end of the world to watch the VR experience, if they only watched chapter one, they were in the experience for 20 plus minutes. If they were watching chapters 1, 2, and 3, they were in the experience for 45 plus minutes, right? This is quality engagement. And this isn't just them hanging out at a movie theater, maybe engaging, maybe not. This is them like fully inside of a VR headset. And so I think the argument can be made that the VR industry as a whole needs to figure out what its ChatGPT is, right? It needs to figure out what its widespread accessibility is going to be that unlocks that ability for everyone to access it. I think that's the promise of ChatGPT, is that you can have this like bespoke high-level AI at your fingertips that can help you with your productivity. We don't yet have that piece unlocked in VR because we don't yet have a headset that makes people feel productive. We only have headsets that make people feel entertained. Just like when the iPhone first came out, it's the idea that you have to integrate something into people's lives so they feel productive using it, and then they'll feel like they can use it for entertainment. So I'm curious to see what Apple does with their headsets. I think it is the first headset to maybe try and pierce that market of productivity versus push into the market of entertainment. I'm curious to see what unfolds with smart glasses. I'm curious to see what unfolds with artificial intelligence and different types of interfaces that we connect to the internet on, because it might not be on top of our faces. It might be immersive projection that you can turn on in your living room one day, right? Like, we can think about this format in many different ways. And just like you said, John, who knows what that's going to be? All we can do is keep trying and seeing what sticks.
I had to think, I saw the other day the Vegas Sphere. Mm-hmm. And I had to think about that as a very interesting place to try mass experiences. Mm-hmm. Not that you are in control of necessarily, but that have a sense of immersion. Any thoughts about that?
I mean, I think anything like the sphere or dome technology, or even like I was talking about before, immersive projection mapping technology, they are kindred spirits to what we're doing in the VR world. I think in the VR industry, we are really trying to make somebody feel like they have agency and they have a character within the story. That's the promise of volumetric VR. That's the promise of interactive VR. But immersive VR, like On the Morning You Wake to the End of the World, is the immersive linear experience. We have two very small moments of interactivity that you may or may not catch, that you may or may not miss, but it doesn't impact the way the story unfolds. It's not a video game in that sense. And I think that is definitely a kindred spirit to these domes, to these immersive projection mapping spaces, to spaces like Spheres. There's another entity called COSM doing something really similar in Los Angeles. This is all just whetting the appetites of people to want to do immersive storytelling. So say you have somebody who constantly goes to the Vegas Sphere or constantly goes to COSM, and they're like, this is so fun. I love consuming this kind of content. I want to consume this kind of content at home. That would maybe potentially lead them to buy a VR headset and vice versa. So to me, it's just strengthening the ecosystem. And if somebody can figure out how to make this ecosystem a little more financially viable, right? Because we did see some of those really high-end location-based hyper-reality experiences like The Void, you know, shut down even with their big partnership with IP like Disney. Dreamscape is kind of holding on by a thread right now, right? So my hope is with some of these massive venues with massive capabilities and capacity and low technical production costs, that if they can stay kind of in the game and make their money back and show that this is financially viable, then that'll also create more of those types of venues all over the world. So my hope is like, yeah, it'll just fertilize the soil of both the audience and the business owners and the locations of real estate developers to want to build and create more of these, to hopefully then feed into the ecosystem of like more individualized home entertainment like VR headsets.
Put your dreamer hat on for a moment and imagine that cost is no object, or maybe that, you know, ChatGPT or OpenAI or somebody, Creative Diffusion, lets you prompt a immersive environment with 6 degrees of freedom. What's the ultimate expression of telling stories in immersive realities? Is it something that you can move around in, that you can participate in, that you can engage in? Is it something that has a narrative story? Are those just two different things? Can you think of, is a game sometimes the right way to tell a story, or should a story have a beginning, a middle, and an end? What are your thoughts about that?
I think the ultimate expression of storytelling and medium is, what is the purpose, right? I think you look at these incredible games like God of War or The Jedi Survivor. Those are very story-driven games, yet they have huge amounts of interactivity. And then you look at, you know, platforms like League of Legends, World of Warcraft, and you see that there's very minimal story being done, and it's all about the interactivity of the game and the competition and the sports aspect of it. But then we see pieces like Arcane do really well on the Netflix, right, with a VR, an animated streaming platform. So I think it really depends on like who the audience is for the creator or the project, what the purpose of it is, and how they want to make the audience feel. Because if I want to make you feel deep, dark emotions, I probably wouldn't put you in a super interactive game, because you're focusing on problem solving versus focusing on reflecting and thinking. So I would probably make something a little more passive, something a little immersive, something a little more linear, or on tracks, as we call it in VR, where I put you on a train and the train takes you on a ride. Versus if I want to make the audience feel energized and make the audience feel like teamwork is possible, then I'd probably make something more of an interactive game where they're kind of pushed into the system of working with other people, collaborating with other people, solving different puzzles, or maybe competing against other teams. And so I think they're all very valuable in life. Like, that's the beauty of the types of people we truly are, is that we move in so many different spaces and so many different labels, right? Like, I can be a dancer and be a professional working in XR. I can be a mother and I can be a professional working in finance. Like, we can code switch very easily as humans. Like, I can be an interactive gamer who loves like intense online esports gaming, but I can also enjoy like a cozy game like Animal Crossing. And so I think that layer of genre and mediums is just going to continue to expand and grow based on the technology that's available to people and based on the technology that's available to creators. So I don't think there's a perfect apex type of storytelling. If anything, there's a perfect apex execution of storytelling, or a perfect apex execution of interactivity, depending on the audience, the creator, and what the creator wants to do and how they want to make the audience feel.
Yeah, and as somebody who would experience it or enjoy it or be part of it, it also depends on me and what I want on a particular time. Maybe I want to get engaged and be involved and do stuff, and maybe sometimes I just want to sit back and experience. This has been a ton of fun. I've really enjoyed hearing what you had to say. Thank you so much for the time. I have to ask you about that painting, artwork behind you. It looks 3D. Is that actual moss that's growing?
It is, yeah. It is a moss wall. I worked with a moss artist and commissioned it, worked with him to design it. Everything is alive, so it is 3D.
Wow.
Different textures, different mosses. The only thing that's not alive are the dried flowers that you see right above.
Okay.
Those dried flowers are not alive, but everything else is alive and it is 3D. And it's really cool because you can look at it from all angles in the apartment and see kind of new details and new
textures. I love it.
Inside of it.
I love it. Care and feeding. You spray it a little bit now and then. Is that about it?
It's honestly the most low maintenance plant I've ever had. If I ever notice that it's wilting or like drying, then I can spray it. But actually the thing I have to do most is feather dust it so it doesn't get dusty.
Very cool. Michaela, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, John. I hope you have a wonderful day.